Hi, and welcome back to the Organizing Therapist. My name is Jack Register, and I am your host. All opinions expressed in this podcast are mine alone and come from my experience as a practitioner, scholar, and advocate, and represent no organization to which I am affiliated or currently contracted with. The purpose of this podcast is to give information to therapists out there about what does it really mean to do what we do, and to take my experience in the policy world and in advocacy and teach some of the foundational skills in self-advocacy and to help us all have a bigger conversation with common vocabulary. So this particular podcast, we're going to talk about the idea of contracting and what are some of the sort of basic language kinds of things. So for some more experienced therapists, this might be somewhat repetitive, but my purpose in doing this is also to give us some common language to operate from. For other folks who are newer to the work or might come out of an environment where you never did any billing, this might be helpful for you in terms of understanding some of the basics in terms of the concerns that practice therapists deal with. Now, the issue here is that you can be in a group practice or in a solo private practice or even in an agency and not necessarily in a quote unquote group practice and still be billing for services. So sometimes the definitions get really wonky depending upon what's going on. So the key thing is to first understand what kind of work are you doing? Who do you work for? I currently am a contract therapist with a couple of different providers, EAP plans, and so on, and I have my own individual solo private practice, which means I've got clients coming in from multiple sources, but I answer to different folks in terms of where documentation goes, or where other issues might show up if I have concerns about what's going on with the client. And so what I do in first and foremost in my own record keeping is that I actually keep things separate so that I understand the flow of where the client's coming from. So if this one is from ABC EAP plan and this one is coming from a contract I have with a particular group practice I might be a part of, and this one is one that I'm seeing through my own practice, all those records and whatnot are all in different places so that I know what's going on. But then I use my EHR, which is simple practice, because for me as a solo person, it makes the most sense. And I'm able to then keep everything in alignment. This helps a lot whenever I'm dealing with issues and concerns around insurance, in terms of private pay and all of those kinds of things. So we're going to start with the idea of the fee-for-service environment. The majority of us operate on the idea that we have a billable clinical contact with the client, and that clinical contact gets billed either through private pay or through insurance. And that's called a fee-for-service contact. Other folks are using perhaps intensives, where these might be extended periods, maybe 3 to 4 hours or even longer, where they bill at sort of a rate for that particular service. So that is a fee-for-service, but for some of us, that looks a little different than we might be used to. And still, other folks are working under contracts where they might get a per diem per client, where they actually see a certain number of clients and they are paid a certain rate. And it is through a contract with whomever the payer source is that this particular revenue comes in. So these might be folks through a health center or that sort of thing, where there's a group of people coming in under a particular contract and you're expected to see them for X amount in terms of the rate. The key thing to do, and this is just something that as someone who is perhaps a little older in the work, I've been around for over 20 years, is I have a spreadsheet and I know it's a flat file and all of those things. So if you have other strategies that work for you, go for it. But I keep a spreadsheet of my client, what their funding source is, what is the particular requirements of that funding source? Do I need to make sure that I'm touching base with them, that they need notes, diagnostics, whatever it happens to be? And then when is the renewal period for that particular funding source? So that I always have a sense of where are my folks coming from? Is someone moving from a private pay to a HSA card for a health savings account and then trying to move to insurance? Are people wanting to use super bills and that sort of thing? So the key is that when you get ready to start your practice, you want to make sure that you're being as intentional as you can in terms of keeping your records clear so that you can follow your own line of logic. Many of us decide to go from a solo practice to a group practice where we might be the group owner and we're then bringing in other people. And so you need to remember that you may be in a situation where it makes sense to you, but if you have other humans who are working for you and it doesn't make sense for them, it's going to be a source of frustration. Now, in terms of all of the nuances of getting ready to be in private practice, all of that is a different conversation, and we'll get to those things later on in the future. We want to make sure that we're doing everything we can right now to be prepared for the money side of things. So, in understanding the fee for service, we want to make sure that we understand the definition is that therapists bill clients directly for services rendered rather than relying on insurance. Now, this particular definition comes out of a generic sort of business manual, but I wanted to show you the difference between how we might see it versus how somebody else might see it. We also need to understand that the implications here are that therapists retain control over pricing per se, right, in a fee for service environment. And can establish our own fee structures. The concern, and as many of us know this, when you have a third party issue going on in terms of reimbursement, you might raise your rates, but you may not necessarily get those rates from an EAP plan or from folks being able to afford you in private practice and so on. So the other piece is that rates for therapy vary across the country. So if you are comparing a very rural market where you are to a very urban market, the rates in terms of reimbursement may not necessarily look the same, even if the experience of the therapist and the credentialing is the same. So we want to make sure that we are really doing an assessment of ourselves within context. We are still subject to all of the other market demands in terms of supply and demand. And if you are in a niche market where you actually have a very specific population that you're serving, you probably can charge bigger fees than somebody who is not in a niche market, who is actually not necessarily maybe more of a generalist or serving populations that tend to be seen by a lot of different kinds of therapists. The next major concern is around contracts. Credentialing with insurance is really, really tough. There's lots of different processes you can go through and lots of third parties who will handle this for you. And the issue around insurance reimbursement is something that is really important for new therapists to understand. In many practices that may set up the pay cycle for you to be, once the insurance reimbursement comes in, that could be 30, 60, or even 90 days after the date of service. So the first thing that is really important for a new practitioner to understand as an employee is that when you are going in, if that is a part of your contract, you need to understand that this means this is not necessarily set up in a regular job where you get a paycheck every 2 weeks or once a month or whatever the cadence is. You're going to get paid when the reimbursement comes in. This does not necessarily mean that the agency is setting you up to fail. This means that you are coming into a business where you are in business for yourself. Most folks who are in a fee-for-service environment as a therapist are in there as a business owner of their own practice. So, for example, Jack LLC, solo practitioner, might go and contract with ABC Counseling Center and come in as a 1099 contractor, knowing that I might see Susie Sand on Tuesday, the 21st of September, but I may not get reimbursed for her until October 15th, right? So the idea is that it takes time for those things to happen. So here's just a helpful hint. When you are interviewing with practices, make sure that you understand what the contract states in terms of who you are, and we'll get more into the 1099 versus W-2 in a moment, and you also understand the issues around how is reimbursement done. If you're not clear with that and you have one expectation and your agency has another expectation, or your contractor has another expectation, you're going to then be in a world of hurt. If you're someone who's doing the hiring of this and you're on the other side of the equation, over communicating, over documenting this stuff for folks, especially for folks who may be new at this and may be coming straight out of graduate school or straight out of their licensing process and may not understand how this particular model works, being really, really clear with that is very important. My recommendation is that you start small. If you're going to be a contract therapist with agencies, do that in a way where you're starting out with two or three clients at a time until you can build. The conventional wisdom is it can take 6 months to a full year before you're at a sustainable level of practice. The average really good therapist in the average market getting the average reimbursements can expect to make between $4,000 to $5,000 a month. That's not a lot if you're expecting to make $10,000 or more. Now, again, that's the average therapist with the average reimbursement rates, seeing the average number of clients, not someone who's in a specialty market doing intensives or other things. There are plenty of therapists who do really, really well, and there are plenty of therapists who are really struggling and are not able to find that balance point. The key thing is to find the balance point that works for you as an individual person. To be credentialed with insurance companies, each insurance company has their own requirements. So if you are someone who does virtual only care and you're someone who does particular modalities, some insurance companies won't touch you because you're a virtual therapist. Some insurance won't com companies won't touch you unless you're independently practiced for a certain number of years. Now, that whole process is beginning to slowly change because of the advent of what happened with COVID and we had to go online, because of the push and the need right now for therapeutic services. So the key thing is to do your homework and be prepared that you're going to have to do some digging and research on every single insurance contract and every EAP contract that you get. A way that I tend to manage this, again, as a solo practitioner without a virtual assistant, is that I use a spreadsheet that says my client's ID number, so I can have this information going with me to different places and potentially in front of folks that may not necessarily be a part of my practice, and I don't want to release HIPAA information. So I create a client ID number for each one of my clients, who their insurance company is, what the particulars of that particular contract are. So, for example, I need to make sure that I'm seeing this person for 30 days before I submit a claim, or I need to make sure that every claim has the diagnostic code, including the ICD code, whatever it happens to be, whatever the nuances are, so that I can keep track of all of that stuff. And that's separate from the first spreadsheet I was mentioning around just payer source, because insurance companies may be different depending upon if someone has a primary and secondary, if someone has TRICARE, which is VA insurance, or any number of other kind of combinations of situations. You really have to be strategic in this. A recommendation from many of the mastermind groups I've been a part of over the years, and from folks who've been in the field for as many years as I have, if not longer, who have grown group practices, is that one of the first hires you should do if you're moving towards a group model is your billing person, because that person is going to be able to manage all of that information and make sure everything gets done correctly. They're going to understand changes in CPT codes and how all of that stuff shows up. In order to get to a point of organizing and actually moving us to a place where we're starting to talk about commonalities within our work, we all need to make sure that we have base level information. And that's the purpose of today's podcast, is to kind of get us all on the same page. In my work as a policy specialist, I specialize in behavioral health and addiction service policy. And one of the things that always came up from working with insurance companies and state governments and service definitions and whatnot are the expectations that we have as the field of the practitioners of not always understanding how this whole process works. And so that's part of the reason why I wanted to put this together for you. Sometimes we can do client agreements or single case agreements. So let's say, for example, that you are at a network with a particular insurance, and your person is only going to use this particular insurance just for you. You might contact them and do a single case agreement. That is a whole process to go through with each individual insurance company. As a solo practitioner, that is just too much for me to be able to manage in order to make sure that someone can use that information. I might decide, on the other hand, to do a super bill where I am saying I'm an out-of-network therapist. I give all the particulars as if I was billing, and I give this to the client in a bill that includes the diagnostic code, the ICD and DSM code, the CPT code. All of that stuff is in there so that they're then able to go to their insurance company themselves and seek reimbursement for services. It's never guaranteed in single case agreements or with super bills that someone is going to get paid. Sometimes we can even move to a sliding scale if we're doing a situation where we actually have capacity to be able to do that, or we might use places like OpenPath, which allows you to take clients where who may not have insurance or have limited means, and they're able to see you for a certain fee. OpenPath manages that particular process, and generally that fee is less than $30. And it allows for folks who don't have access to care to be able to get access. If you're someone who's employing brand new people. So let's say you've got a new associate level clinician who's just out of school, just getting their license and just getting started. OpenPath would be a way for them to start getting the experience that they need and to actually being able to have hours. I, as a business owner, for example, would only give one or two clients like that to a new clinician. But if you had a student intern, that would be the majority of where I would draw clients for them from, because that fee is low enough that a intern can see them and it not be detrimental to someone who's trying to do this as their income source. And students can also get the experience that they need working with folks. Just ensure that the supervision elements are in place. So sometimes we actually have in the billing processes a direct billing versus an insurance billing. And a direct billing might mean that we're sending stuff directly to the payer source versus a third-party clearinghouse. Many EHRs or electronic health records will use a third-party clearinghouse. So, for example, I use Simple Practice. And so, if I'm billing insurance directly through them, that goes through a third party. And then all of those processes are done in order for then me to get paid by them. Know that the practitioner's ID or your NPI number is attached to all of this, which means if there's concerns, it's coming back on you as the provider, not necessarily the third party that you sent everything through. This can be incredibly problematic if there's problems or there's clawbacks, and you're not necessarily completely clear as the practitioner on the entire process. Some systems are being built in order to have client verification or insurance verification in advance before the session. So, something that I have learned over the years is to once a quarter, I actually ask for folks to give me new contact data, new insurance data, and new credit card data. Just because some people might change those cards, it might change that information. And it's just a way for me to be able to then on a regular basis make sure that I'm updating all of that information. So I've set things up in Simple Practice to send out a request every quarter from the time that that person starts for renewal of that information, just so that we're always on the same page with it. Pre-authorization services may show up depending upon what your particular intervention is. For most of us in outpatient care, that's not really going to be the case. But what you want to make sure that you have documented from whatever referral source that your person is coming in with is your medical necessity. So this is going to mean how did the person initially come into the behavioral health system? What practitioner, their primary care physician or someone else sent them in, or if they came in on their own? Is there something that the medical doctor can say, yes, this person does have a long history of depression? Just so that you have that, because some insurance companies are going to want to see that. Making sure that you're being really clear about regulatory compliance, and this is everything from HIPAA to your email to your phone and how your practice is set up. We'll get into some of those specifics down the road. I strongly recommend if you're going to be a virtual only practitioner, that you look at some of the certifications that are available in telemental health. There's several groups out there that are doing national certifications. This won't necessarily protect you if you get into trouble, but it does show a competence. It does show that you've actually done some specific continuing education and received a certificate or even a credential to be able to do that. So, for example, 90% of my practice is virtual. So, I'm a board certified telemental health counselor, and that allows people to know that I actually have some recognizable credentialing in that particular arena. When you're navigating denials and appeals, if you receive something that says, hey, Jack, your payment for Jane Doe on X date is being denied for these reasons, make sure to follow up on all of that stuff really quickly. So typically, you get what's called an explanation of benefits from an insurance company where you're actually able to say, okay, so this is what's going on. This is what they billed. This is what the plan says that they're eligible to have or not have. And honestly, most clients do not understand the nuances of their particular plan. So you may have co-pays, you may have co-insurance, you may have a deductible, you may have all different kinds of stuff going on that may or may not affect what's happening in terms of your processes. So be clear about that, and you're going to have to launch an appeal process for every claim that's denied. As you can probably imagine, this starts to become a lot of work. Many people leave insurance because it's just a very big headache that takes a lot of really staying on top of. And then insurance companies may, if they hold things out or keep the ne delaying the claim or whatnot and delay it 90 plus days, can then say the claim's too old. So you may still be in a situation where that particular claim is not necessarily going to be paid. Now, why is all of this conversation about insurance and the nuances of all of this stuff really important in terms of the field of organizing therapists together? If we don't understand the context by which we're operating, and we don't understand the nuances of the sort of machinery of behavioral health, which is not only the processes that we deal with in terms of the systems that bring clients to us, but if we don't understand the reimbursement systems, our organizing efforts at higher rates, at ease of being able to remove clients who might be inappropriate, or the concerns that might come up around a client who goes into crisis, we could really be into trouble if we're not going to the right place with our advocacy. So, for example, the way in which the sort of definitions or service definitions in state language, those are set by state policy, which are typically set by state governments. They are influenced, however, by the national level through the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. One of the advocacy sort of taglines is where goes Medicare, the rest of the system will follow within 5 years. Because Medicare sets the federal standards for what's going to be covered under the public benefit of Medicare and thereby under public benefits of Medicaid, which is the state insurance. So remember, red, white, and blue cards of Medicare are national. The colored cards of the states are going to be varying in terms of different looks and whatnot, and they are not consistent. States can opt in or opt out of the service menu available. So some state Medicaid plans may not cover something that another state Medicaid plan would. So for folks who are working across multiple jurisdictions, who are trying to get reimbursements for the same service for a different client that you're providing in a different state, you have to be really, really, really clear whether or not that particular service is covered. Again, going back to my spreadsheet idea, the second spreadsheet where I list out the ID number for the client, what their insurance payer source is, what's covered and what's not, I detail for myself all of that stuff. So if I specialize in both addiction and mental health issues, so if I'm doing some basic level addictions work with somebody in terms of motivational interviewing and whatnot, and I see in their plan none of that's covered, I can only take a behavioral health lens because at the state level in their Medicaid plan, that may not be covered at all. So it's something that you have to be super careful of. Not all virtual care is going to be covered by state insurance. So you have to make sure that that's something that's in play as well. And so those are just nuance of pieces that you have to make sure that you know. And so the issue is that ignorance does not get you out of a clawback. If you didn't know that you couldn't do something and you can do it in another jurisdiction, it's not going to keep an insurance company from coming after you for a payback. Consultation and supervision, to be honest with you, are absolutely critical survival skills. You have to make sure that you have a consultation group, and there are plenty of those in social media where you can just get into a group and say, hey, I practice in Utah, for example, and I'm having concerns with this particular CPT code. Can anybody give me any insight? You want to make sure you're hearing what's going on. You also want to make sure you stay dialed into what's happening in terms of diagnostics. What does the state say about diagnostics? Because in some states, master's level practitioners across the board, which are social workers and counselors and marriage and family folks and addiction folks, psych nurses, and so on, all of those folks may be able to diagnose, but there may be nuances of what that diagnosis looks like. Okay. Not everybody has a full independent scope of practice. Master's level psychologist folks have to make sure they can guarantee and prove that they're under supervision. In many states, addiction folks who are able to be clinicians cannot see folks in the behavioral health only diagnostics. They have to have an addiction first diagnosis in order to be seen, but that's not the same across the country. And then the other piece is that we are small businesses. As practitioners, Whether you're a solo practice like I am, or you're someone in a group practice, or you're even someone in an agency, we are businesses. So we have to be set up with business practice basics. I strongly recommend using the Small Business Administration. There are academies that you can go through at the community college level or just going to the SBA yourself. So if you're a solo practitioner, just going through some of their online webinars in terms of how do companies actually organize themselves would be really, really helpful. I have found that through the SBA, I have learned things I had never thought about in terms of how to run the business more effectively. Because insurance companies are, and the systems are really complex and they're always changing, therapists have to be clear about what all of this stuff means. There are things like value-based care, which is sort of a bundled billing sort of model, how telehealth has impacted reimbursements. And so really kind of staying up on not only the skills we need for practice itself and all the continuing education involved, but also the business acumen and the sort of current political landscape. So a recommendation I would give to folks, take five additional CEs every year that are not going to count towards your license, but are going to count towards your business health. So give yourself permission to say, okay, I need to pay for five additional CEs around business ethics, around billing concerns, or whatever it happens to be. In many cases, that's one additional conference, that's one additional training, or maybe even a couple of self-directed webinars. But what you can do by doing that is to build in a regular cadence of making sure that you are staying up on how do I stay compliant as possible in the situation that I'm in. There is huge amounts of financial stress when you're a private practitioner. It is hard to hold space and do the work that we do if you're also worried about payments and if you're also worried about your own sanity. So it's really important that you have a support system. If you're going into private practice, if you're going into solo practice, make sure you talk it over with your family so that they understand what's up. If you're going into a practice as a 1099 versus W-2 and you're not going to have a predictable paycheck, make sure you talk it over with your family. Now, this does bring me back to the idea of the difference between 1099s and W-2. 1099 folks are contracts, which means you are responsible for your own taxes. There are no benefits whatsoever. And in a lot of cases, you use your own equipment and whatnot to be able to practice in that particular agency. If you're doing telehealth as a 1099 contractor, you are responsible for ensuring that your technology is HIPAA compliant, meaning that your phone, your email, your fax, if you have it, your EHR, whatever it is that you're doing in that particular context, the practitioner is the one responsible for ensuring HIPAA compliance. If you're a W-2 employee, then your employer takes over all of that stuff because you are a part of their organization. They are paying taxes on you and all of those other sorts of things. Now, it is common for 1099 to be the starting point where many companies will hire therapists as a 1099 contractor. If you've never been in a 1099 position before, that means you have to pay your own taxes, which means you've got to be super duper careful. So the way to live with this in reality is whenever you get a paycheck, 70% of it is cool. You use that. 30% of it goes back towards taxes. I sometimes will do a little bit more depending upon the jurisdiction that I'm in. If you've got to pay local taxes and you're looking at local, state, and federal taxes. But in general, a 30% mark is one that you can use for this and still be okay. Making sure that you are diverse, meaning that you are willing to look at how you're getting clients in from different sources. So you might be getting clients in from EAPs, you might be getting them in from direct referrals, and so on. And just being open to the idea of diversifying that process. But the more you diversify, the more complex it gets, and the more it is really, really tough to make sure you've got everything in a, all your ducks in a row in terms of protecting your practice. The number one thing that I have said to new practitioners over the years as a clinical supervisor, as a consultant, and as an advocate is to protect your business first, because you can't do anything for anybody if you don't have the right business. Being flexible and adaptable to the changes in the market are really important. Making sure that you're setting your rules and your standards. So I'm a solo practitioner. I don't have as flexible a policy around people canceling, you only have 24 hours in advance. If a last minute crisis comes up and you don't communicate with me, I may not charge you the full rate, but I'm going to charge you something because you held that spot, which then cost me money as a practitioner because I wasn't able to put somebody else in there. It's a harsher thing and a harsher perspective to understand, but I am responsible for providing my own income source. So I have to make sure I'm doing everything possible to communicate that. Also, the notion around common language is making sure that not only in the clinical space, because many of us, when we're talking to each other and we're consulting on cases, we're able to be really clear about scope of practice and what's going on and what's the evidence of the diagnosis and what's the history and all of that stuff. From the business side of things, we need to have a common language as well. So regardless of your discipline, we need to make sure that we are speaking the same language in terms of what's our reimbursement systems like, what's our client acquisition like, what's our marketing funnels look like, what is our EHR and all the HIPAA compliance stuff look like, how are we ensuring compliance? Because those are things that will take a private practice out in no time at all. And so making sure that you are being intentional about your growth is really important. So those are the issues I wanted to bring up for folks today in terms of what is the sort of common language, what is sort of the idea of how do we get to a place where we're looking at things from a similar viewpoint. We're going to be adding some forms to the website, and my website, by the way, is jack-register.com. This is a part of my practice. I have a coaching practice and a clinical practice, and this particular podcast and all the associated website stuff is a part of my coaching services because I don't really want to put it into my clinical website for my practice. And keeping those things separate becomes a really, really smart thing to do. So I have actually separate LLCs for one for the clinical practice and one for coaching and everything else. The big piece is that if you want to find out what we're about, check out my website, jack-register.com. Look for the organizing therapist, and we'll have some forms on the website for you to be able to fill out, give us some feedback, and tell us what you'd like to do, especially if you'd like to come on the podcast and give us your insights. Really appreciate your time today, my friends. Take care of yourselves and be well.